May it please the court?
Certainly.
Yesterday, I was interviewed by a reporter about the three cases today. Jesse Bogan from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch has taken an interest in these cases. And he asked me standard questions, and in the middle of the interview, he stopped me and he said, "But Ms. Mitchell, why should Missourians care about this law? Why should they care about your clients?" And the answer is simple, because this is the ultimate deprivation of liberty. This is the ultimate confinement, and Mr. Hopkins' custody will never end. He will never be out of government control now that he has been committed as an SVP. It's statutorily impossible under the current version of our law. But constitutional commitments are only potentially indefinite, because the government has no interest in confining someone who's not both mentally ill and dangerous. So under every other SVP commitment law in this country, discharge is possible. But that's not the case in Missouri. And Mr. Hopkins will remain in custody until he dies, regardless of whether he met criteria in the first place or continues to do so. It is the ultimate restraint on the fundamental liberty interest at the core of due process protections.
Can you address why it's not premature to raise that now, where you don't claim that under a different system he would be qualified for release?
Yes, that's a great question, Judge. And we can look at Hendricks. The United States Supreme Court has only approved one state SVP scheme. And to do so, it looked at the back end of the law. It looked at immediate discharge from confinement as one of the reasons why it found the law was civil and constitutional. We have to look at the impact of Section 632.505 and the other amendments made in 2006 and how that changed the landscape of civil commitment.
It looked at that to decide if it was punitive or not. Is that the only thing it's relevant for at this point?
No, there are other reasons why our law is punitive, and there are other things that the Kansas Act had that we don't have. In Hendricks, the United States Supreme Court said that statutory scheme was not punitive because it disavowed punitive intent. It was limited to a narrow class of individuals. There were strict procedural safeguards and evidentiary standards. It conferred the same status on men committed as SVPs as other people civilly committed in that state, recommended treatment if possible, and six permitted immediate release. In the course of the three arguments today, you'll see that the Missouri SVP Act doesn't afford any of these six protections. And because of the liberty interest at stake, the statute must be strictly construed against the state. It also must be reviewed under strict scrutiny.
Would you comment on the recent case out of the Eighth Circuit, the Minnesota case, right? Judge Shepherd authored an opinion that said these are subject to rational basis analysis.
Yes,
is this just a different statute, or was he wrong about the appropriate test to apply?
I think both. It is a different statute, and I think the court was wrong. And I think we can look to Hendricks for what standard of review applies. The Kansas Supreme Court struck down the law initially, and it did so under strict scrutiny. The United States Supreme Court didn't say Kansas was wrong. It also didn't explicitly state, "and we're going to apply strict scrutiny." It would be super helpful for us if it did. We wouldn't be arguing that. But it did tell us in other ways that's the standard it was applying. It talked about constitutionally protected liberty interests that could only be overridden in certain narrow circumstances with proper procedures and evidentiary standards. And it explains how the proper procedures and protections show great care on the part of Kansas to confine only a narrow class of individuals. This language suggests that the law must be narrowly tailored to achieve compelling government interests.
Do you know the status of that case? Did either party seek cert and was it granted?
I'm not sure about that. I know that the Eighth Circuit remanded it back for findings under rational basis, mm-hmm. and so some of the claims are still alive. It was my understanding that the plaintiffs were going to seek cert, but there could have been some other compromises in the case, and so I'm not sure. I haven't heard an update on that recently, so I can look into that and provide information in a letter brief to the court if I find out.
If you would, please.
Mm-hmm. That decision and application of rational basis was also contrary to other Eighth Circuit opinions. I've cited some in all of my briefs in these cases where the Eighth Circuit applied strict scrutiny to civil commitments because of the infringement of liberty. So it seems to be inconsistent. But this court has never been inconsistent. This court has always applied strict scrutiny and has always recognized the fundamental liberty interest at stake, and it should continue to do so today and every time this law is reviewed. In addition to signaling that strict scrutiny applied, like I'd mentioned, Kansas looked at the back end of the law to declare the front end and the entire statutory scheme constitutional, because the Kansas law permitted immediate release. It required that someone be immediately discharged if at an annual review the government couldn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that continued confinement was justified, or if at any other point in time during confinement the individual no longer met criteria. As a result, the United States Supreme Court said that commitment was only potentially indefinite and that it was linked to the stated purpose, holding someone until they were no longer dangerous. But our amendments in 2006 eliminated this safeguard. It also eliminated the beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof, and it eliminated these annual and judicial reviews for some men under the law. Now, under the law, even if someone is conditionally released, they remain in the custody of the Department of Mental Health for care, control, and treatment forever.
The state argues that the person has a right to review of the conditions of release, and that the court could determine that the only condition for release could be something that was otherwise required by law, such as that there not be any violations of criminal sexual statutes. Can you address whether that same requirement that a person would be subject to anyway is the equivalent of having a an unconditional release or a discharge?
It isn't an unconditional release and it isn't a discharge because they're forever oversight because of the status that we have conferred upon them to the court and to the Department of Mental Health. Even if the court says the only condition is to not commit another loss offense, that doesn't remove other statutory provisions that say you are always supervised and under the care, control, and treatment of the Department of Mental Health, who could impose other conditions. I interpret Section 632.505 differently than the state. When Mr. Goodwin and I were here last, I believe it was in January, he believed and argued that the court could remove all of the conditions. But when I read the statutory language, the only conditions that the court can review are those that are submitted by the Department of Mental Health.
And is there language in the statute addressing this directly either way?
I think it is. But if the statute is ambiguous, then it must be construed against the state and in favor of my client, given the liberty interest. So the statute says that when someone is being conditionally released, the Department of Mental Health shall put together a release plan and submit conditions to the court. The next section in the first sentence says the court shall review those conditions. That is modifying or discussing the immediate prior section, which is the extra conditions that the Department of Mental Health would provide to the court and recommend.
What kind of conditions do you think it does not apply to?
I don't think it applies to the things that follow next. The next sentence says, and the court shall order the following conditions to apply. And then there are about 21 statutory conditions listed in 632.505. Those are mandatory. The statute doesn't say, and the court may reconsider these, or the court may determine if these are appropriate. The court's discretion to determine the appropriateness of any conditions is limited to those that are submitted by the Department of Mental Health that aren't required by the statute.
Now, the state argues that your client never presented any evidence on release procedures to the probate court, and therefore that argument can't be made here. Would you respond to that?
I think that's an illusory argument. One, because Hendricks definitely looked at the back end of the law and what release looked like and if someone could be discharged. We can't be discharged. We have to look at what release looks like under the plain language of the statute. And two, the state successfully litigated a motion in limine preventing me from presenting any evidence on Mr. Hopkins' part about what commitment would look like, what he would do if he were not committed. So I don't think the state gets the benefit of an argument now. I was successful in making sure they couldn't present any defense about this or evidence about this at the trial court. Therefore, there's none in the record, and they can't make these arguments.
Are you arguing, you're not arguing release because you're saying he's entitled to release and the conditions are onerous? You're arguing it in support of your argument that it's punitive.
It is punitive,
The statute is, as opposed to as applied to him, so the specific.
Right. The statute on its face is punitive because it would never allow discharge and it requires these conditions.
Assuming just for the purpose of my question, we were to agree with you, why would the answer be to find it punitive as opposed to at an appropriate time, say, some of those, that portion of the statute's not enforceable that makes it impossible to have an unconditional release?
The court could do that. I think the better course of action is to declare the law unconstitutional or punitive and treat these as the criminal punitive proceedings that they truly are. Until I started bringing these appeals in the last 6 months or so, the SVP appeals tended to present isolated issues. Just look at this part of the statute, this one subsection, this one part of one subsection, instead of looking at it as a whole. And we do need to look at this as a whole because it's one SVP law. And if we start changing just a little line here, just a little line there, we find out years down the road that had other implications that we didn't anticipate at the time. And so if we want to commit someone in Missouri, let's do it with integrity. Let's send it back to the legislature and say, you must comply with constitutional standards, and this version of the law doesn't. It's on the legislature to fix the law. This court could declare portions of it are inapplicable or don't apply, but we can't rewrite the law for the legislature. We can't tell it what it needs to say instead, or just add these conditions here and omit those conditions there and put the package together and send it to them. There's precedent from this court that I've cited in my briefs that the remedy is to strike down the law and not to rewrite it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. There's no legal issue in this case that distinguishes it from the other five cases that have been argued or shortly will be argued. And there's no real compelling reason why this court should strike down sexually violent predator law. Before I dive too deep into my argument, I want to answer Judge Fisher's question. I contacted the Minnesota Attorney General's office this morning. A petition for certiorari was lodged by the petitioners in that case on Friday. It has not yet been docketed at the Supreme Court. But in a response to your other question, is it a different statute or a different standard? It is a different statute, but the Eighth Circuit's rationale looks at all sexually violent predator laws. The analysis that they do is not, in terms of what level of scrutiny should apply, is not specific to each type of law, or rather each individual state's law, but to the type of law. And that comports with what Hendricks talks about. Hendricks talks about how at the time of the founding, the Constitution allowed, and the states did, civilly commit individuals who are both mentally ill and dangerous.
And we do, though, accord strict scrutiny to other in other situations to those who are civilly committed. And we look carefully. We provide certain additional requirements, certain protections, because we recognize they're going to be confined and losing their liberty. Why would this be different?
Correct. There is a burden that's placed on a liberty interest, but it's not a fundamental liberty interest. And the statute does provide several protections for these individuals. They have the right to an attorney. They have a right to appear. They have a probable cause.
And yet it's only a rational basis. Isn't that inconsistent to say you have all these additional rights because this does impinge your liberty interest? We've always held otherwise that liberty interests are fundamental, but this one's not.
It's not inconsistent, Your Honor. And the United States Supreme Court in Hendricks talks about how the mechanisms of the acts only need to be reasonably related to the act's purpose.
They didn't address what level of scrutiny.
That's true. Yeah. But they did say, the majority opinion does say, that they look to see if there's a reasonable relation. is that
are you then you must be explicitly asking us to overrule the Norton case and the Burnett case where we held and then reaffirmed that we believe a liberty interest is a fundamental interest and found it subject to strict scrutiny and then found that in fact the state had met that standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I do specifically ask the court to reconsider its holding in Norton and Burnett. And in my brief, the state discusses the cases that this court relied on in finding a fundamental liberty interest. And some of those cases are discussed in the Carjans case from the Eighth Circuit. Mm-hmm. But to go back to your earlier point about the level of protections, that's almost an argument that penalizes the state for providing more protections. The more protections that the state provides, the higher the level of...
So you're saying the U.S. Supreme Court would say none of those protections are necessary?
No. It's my understanding that the United States Supreme Court, were they to review Missouri's law, would say that these protections are necessary, but that they are subject, like the rest of the Act, to a rational basis review. And that's... The converse of that is an argument that was made back in 2000 in the jury trial case out of the Western District. In that case, the putative SVP argued that because the state was required to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, that must be evidence of the putative intent of the law. But now that the standard is clear and convincing evidence, putative SVPs argue that that's proof that the law's intention is punitive. So no matter...
But those are really two very separate issues. Whether we think they're punitive is punitive is different than whether we think the liberty interest in not being confined is a fundamental right.
That's right. Those are separate. But the broader point that I was trying to make, Your Honor, is that when the state provides additional protections, then that's argued as evidence of a punitive intent for the law. And when the state changes some of those protections, that's argued as evidence that the law really was punitive from the beginning. And it puts the state in a very difficult... It's a rule, essentially, where the state always loses. And that can't be the rule in these cases.
But I think your argument is also, whichever standard we apply, the state wins here. Why would that be the case?
That's correct. Well, because since this court has explained that strict scrutiny, that the state's statute survives strict scrutiny, there's no reason to reverse that. The law has not changed in a way that's significant.
Well, opposing counsel says, and I know you say that some changes were made earlier, but none of our cases addressed changes at issue here. And Hendricks and other cases have talked about the ability to obtain discharge at the end, and now you cannot do that. Can you address opposing counsel's argument that changes the analysis?
Yes. So the United States Supreme Court has explained that there is a level of imposition on a liberty interest that is so de minimis that it does not invoke constitutional protections. That's Bell versus Wolfish from the United States Supreme Court. It's true that discharge was removed in the 2006 amendments, but Section 632.505, subsection 3, says that the court shall review the plan and determines the conditions that the court deems necessary to meet the person's need for treatment and supervision and to protect the safety of the public. The court shall order that the person shall be subject to the following conditions. And then that's the 21-point list, I think, that opposing counsel mentioned. But a following section of 632.505 sub 6 says that the court may modify conditions of release upon its own motion, upon the motion or the petition rather of the Department of Mental Health, the Department of Corrections, or the person on conditional release. And the beginning section of that chapter, section 505 sub 1, says the primary purpose of conditional release is to provide outpatient treatment and monitoring to prevent the person's condition from deteriorating to the point where they would need to be returned to a secure facility or because they're a threat to the public.
Can you address, just so I understand better how the process would work, if, because you're saying it's de minimis, but I'm wondering if it's sort of like being on probation where if you prove someone violated a condition, say they're alleged to have committed another criminal act, you would have to prove that criminal act in order to confine them for the criminal act. But
correct.
Would it simply be what would be the standard for proving it in order to revoke the conditional release?
And there hasn't been an appellate case on that point on Missouri statute, but my understanding from looking at the statute is it would be treated the same as a probation revocation.
But we do say you're entitled to all sorts of protections. You're still entitled to seek habeas and so forth if you're on probation because right. you're not truly free of and at liberty. Why isn't the same? You don't think the same is true here. Why not?
No, certainly the individuals who are conditionally released with the de minimis condition that they not commit another sexually violent offense are entitled to the same protections, habeas, an attorney. And when revocation proceedings are filed, individuals are entitled to the same protections that other individuals are. But the broader question is whether that de minimis condition, removing all the reporting requirements, removing the necessity for an individual to report for an evaluation, that does not rise to the level that it transforms this conditional release into unlimited, burdensome supervision of an individual such that the law is transformed into a punitive statute.
Is it the state's position that we have to interpret the statute in the way that you're arguing in order for it to be constitutional, that the state is saying the court should interpret it to allow all those conditions to be released so that it does pass constitutional scrutiny?
This court's precedents talk about that when a law is challenged as being unconstitutional, intendments, I think is the word, are made in favor of the act's validity. That's the standard of review that should be applied in this case. If there's any ambiguity, which there isn't by the plain language of the statute, that ambiguity should be resolved in such a way to empower courts to do what the purpose of the act is, to protect individuals and provide treatment at the lowest level of imposition on their liberty. Other states have a binary release. Either you're in complete control or you're completely released, thrown out on the streets with no access to state resources. Missouri has adopted a graduated approach, and that's not something that the state should be punished for by trying to create a system that tailors the level of state supervision and state resources to an individual's current mental abnormality and dangerousness. In Missouri, as an individual becomes less dangerous or less mentally ill, they get more and more access and less state supervision. That's a success of the law, not a failure. And so when you read the entire statute, you know, one section of 505 sub 3 can't be read to undercut the provision of the entire act. That's the Middleton case. You know, each word has to have a meaning. A clause can't undermine a section. When you read 505 in its entirety, it's clear that the legislature's intent is to provide a graduated approach that maximizes an individual's liberty while also maximizing the amount of state resources and protection for state citizens that are appropriate. And so I think when the statute is read together in that way, it does pass constitutional muster, either under strict scrutiny or rational basis. The other topic that I just wanted to briefly touch upon is the last point that Mr. Hopkins presents in his brief, a challenge to jury selection. And there's another challenge to the juror selection procedures, in one of the other cases that will be argued, but those cases are very fact-specific, and deference is given to the trial court. And so I wanted to briefly discuss that. In this case, the issue is whether an individual who raised their hand during voir dire to a question that was found to be confusing by the trial court was properly struck. The answer is yes. Other veneer men on the panel and veneer women indicated that they found that the question was confusing. The trial court, who's in the best position to observe the voir dire and the veneer people's responses, found the question was confusing and so refused to strike the juror. Mr. Hopkins argues that there is some obligation on the court to conduct a follow-up inquiry or ask additional questions, and that is true, but only when an individual gives an equivocal response. And a hand raised to a question that everyone agrees was confusing is not the kind of equivocal response that requires a follow-up from the trial court. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
I would just briefly conclude by saying that all of the other issues that are raised in this case, other than the juror selection, fact-specific juror selection claim that we just discussed, are raised in the other cases. And none of those legal theories rise to the level of trial court error, let alone to the level of error that would be an abuse of the probate court's discretion. And so there's no compelling reason why Mr. Hopkins is entitled to relief, and I would ask that the court deny his direct appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not only does the state argue there's no fundamental liberty interest involved in lifetime commitment without the possibility of discharge, it also claims that now we're penalizing the state because it provides too many protections. This is indicative of the state's attitude in civil commitment, that it doesn't matter because we don't like these people, so we can do what we want. That's not how our Constitution operates, and that's not how this court has operated. Mr. Hopkins committed a crime, and he was punished for that crime, and he deserved to be punished for that crime, but it does not mean he has no liberty interest because he committed a crime. His liberty interest survives prison, and it survives civil commitment. The court had asked Mr. Goodwin about violations if someone has been conditionally released in the process. It is not really like probation revocations, as Mr. Goodwin argues, and the Act tells us exactly what happens. The statute says that if the Department of Mental Health or the PO or the court or a law enforcement agent believes that someone who's been conditionally released needs to be brought back into custody, they can do that unilaterally without any determination by the court.
There's no right to petition a court to review
that? You can, but they can be brought back into custody at any time for any reason. The Department of Mental Health could do that, arguing it would be in the best interest of the client, not because he had committed a crime, if that was the only condition left upon him. At that point in time, he could petition the court for review, and the state could ask the court to revoke the conditional release status. But if there are no conditions on release, what possible violation could he have made? What status, what would be the benefit in revoking that status, except to put someone back into custody whom we didn't want to let out in the first place? Due process is hard, and it is costly, and it should cost the state. And it does mean that sometimes the state should lose, because we have to value individual liberty. We have to care about Mr. Hopkins, and we have to care about the other men. If we are going to have civil commitment continue in Missouri, we must recognize that it is punitive, and that therefore he is entitled to all of the other criminal protections that anyone else subject to lifetime custody without the possibility of release is entitled to. We must treat him the same as everyone else who is civilly committed in Missouri, because a criminal conviction and sentence, even a sex conviction and sentence, has no bearing on determining whether or not he is mentally ill or dangerous. And he is entitled to the same protections that Missouri gives every other civil committee if we're going to declare that the law is civil and continue on that path. But I urge the court to look at what we have seen since 1999. When the court first approved this law and said it was civil, we assumed it would not have any punitive effect. The court's opinions even said someone would be discharged. Those things no longer happen and are no longer true.
Thank you. Your time is up. We'll hear from you in the next case. Case will be submitted.